At the call of fire, Van Gort whirled away from the bar, moving fast for a man of his ungainly bulk. The wounded outlaw shot to his feet, but the one with the broken leg stayed where he was. Matt figured he'd better get up too, so the others wouldn't get suspicious of him just yet. He followed Van Gort and the Owl Hoot to the door of the trading post.
God damn! Everyone out through the barn! We must put the fire out!
The Indian woman hurried from behind the bar, and three more women, all of them breeds, came running down the stairs, the Dutchman's regular sporting women. The prisoners were still locked up. The guard ran down the stairs behind the whores. Fire trumped just about every other concern on the frontier. Matt hesitated just enough to let the others rush out ahead of him without being too obvious about it. He watched them stream across the courtyard in the Dutchman's wake. As soon as Matt was alone in the trading post with the broken leg outlaw, he turned and strode toward the man.
Hey, ain't you gonna help them fight that fire?
Nope.
Oh.
Moving quickly, Matt holstered his revolver and plucked a Winchester from a rack on the wall. He took a box of cartridges from a nearby shelf and thumbed the rounds into the rifle's loading gate until the 15-shot magazine was full. Then, carrying the Winchester, he stepped onto the trading post's porch and pushed through the hanging vines. Outside, men were running back and forth from the barn to the well, bringing back buckets of water that they flung on the raging flames. The blaze spread quickly. Great tongues of fire licked out the barn's doors. Matt didn't know where Sam was, but he was willing to bet his blood brother was somewhere close by. For a second, worry tickled the back of Matt's brain. Then,
everybody freeze and drop your guns. You're covered.
Do it. I'll ventilate the first man who tries anything.
The Dutchman, gaping in shock, turned first toward the corral and then toward the trading post. Several of the other men were looking back and forth too, obviously confused.
Kill them! Kill them both!
Some of the guards hesitated, but others instinctively followed Van Gort's orders and clawed for their guns as they dropped the buckets. A slug from Matt's Winchester plowed into a man's chest and drove him backward off his feet. At the same time, gun flame lanced from the darkness of the corral. That would be Sam, Matt thought. He worked the rifle's lever again and shifted his aim. The glare from the flames made Van Gort's men good targets. Matt and Sam each dropped another man before heavy fire from the remaining guards forced Matt to dive back onto the porch. Matt slammed three more shots from the Winchester as fast as he could work the lever and saw two guards go down. Sam was still firing from the corral. Another of Van Gort's men stumbled, fell to his knees, and then toppled over on his side. The deadly accuracy of Matt and Sam accounted for more than half of the Dutchman's guards. Van Gort suddenly thrust his arms in the air.
Hold your fire! Hold your fire! We surrender!
Throw down your guns!
Van Gort and his men did so. The Indian women put their hands in the air as well. The fight appeared to be over. Matt stood up and stepped off the porch again. Sam came to the corral fence and bent to duck between the rails. Both of the Blood Brothers still held their guns ready to fire at an instant's notice. A shot suddenly blasted from the watchtower. Matt's hat flew from his head. Sam pivoted smoothly, angled his Colt up, and fired in less than the blink of an eye.
Blast it! I just shot a woman!
Matt gestured with the barrel of his rifle, herding the Dutchman and the remaining guards together in a compact knot so he could cover them without any trouble.
Go check it out, but be careful!
Sam nodded and trotted over to the ladder leading up to the partially enclosed platform atop the tower. He holstered his revolver and began to climb. Matt couldn't watch him. He had to focus on the men and women he just took prisoner. One of them might still try something.
What about my barn? It's going to be destroyed!
I wouldn't go looking for a lot of sympathy, mister. Not the way you were holding those women captive and making them whore for you.
You lied to me. You are lawmen, yeah?
We're not lawmen, but our names aren't Smith and Jones either.
Matt herded the prisoners into a small stone building used as a smokehouse. The thick walls, heavy door, and lack of windows ensured it wouldn't be easy for them to get out of there, especially with the beam that could be dropped in a couple of brackets across the door to bar it closed. Evidently, the building had been used to lock up prisoners on occasion in the past. Sam was climbing down from the watchtower with the unconscious form of the lookout over his shoulder.
Get those women on the second floor loose. I'll check the bodies of the ones we shot.
Sam nodded agreement and hurried into the trading post. Carefully, Matt made sure the men they downed earlier were really dead. All of them were. One of the dead men, Matt noted with a grimace, had his arm in a sling. One of the outlaws. One of the leads to the gang that raided Buckskin. Matt hoped the fellow with the broken leg could still talk. Sam and the Buckskin women emerged from the trading post.
Let's wet down the other buildings, just to make sure the fire doesn't spread.
Yeah, then we'll have a little talk with that fella inside.
Alice Fletcher and the other women from Buckskin were more than happy to pitch in and help, carrying buckets of water from the well to throw on the other buildings in the compound. They let the fire go ahead and burn in the barn until the place was gutted inside. Since the adobe walls wouldn't burn, the flames began to die out once most of the wood and straw inside was consumed. Matt and Sam let the women keep an eye on the dwindling fire and went inside the trading post. The owl hoot with the broken leg was still unconscious, though he began to stir a mite. Matt saw Sam took the time earlier to use the man's belt and tie his hands together behind his back.
I didn't think he was going anywhere, but I wanted to make sure he couldn't use his crutches.
Smart thinking. Wake up, mister. Time we had a talk.
Who are you fellas? What do you want?
My friend here is Matt Bodine.
And he's Sam Two Wolves.
Shit!
What's your name?
Dave. Dave Ash.
Well, I'll tell you, Dave. We know you were riding with Deuce Mallory and his gang when they hit Buckskin a couple of days north of here. There's no point in you trying to deny it.
Sam knelt on the other side of Dave Ash and drew a hunting knife from its sheath at his waist. Lamplight gleamed on the razor-sharp blade as he turned it from side to side.
My father was a Cheyenne war chief. The Cheyenne aren't like the Apaches or the Comanches. We don't torture folks for the fun of it.
Sam lowered the knife until the tip rested just under Ash's chin.
We torture folks for a reason.
I wouldn't give him a reason if I were you.
What do you want from me?
We want you to tell us where Mallory was headed from here. We know he left you and that other fellow behind because you were hurt. I reckon he had some destination in mind and didn't want to wait.
Tell us where we can find him.
Ash winced when his gulp caused his chin to move just enough so the tip of Sam's blade broke the skin.
Sweet Apple! That's where Deuce was going. A town called Sweet Apple, down by the Rio Grande.
Heard of it?
Yeah. Supposed to be hell on wheels, despite the name.
Deuce was gonna clean the place out, just like we did Buckskin. Then head straight across the border into Mexico. Are you boys gonna go after him?
What do you think?
If Sweet Apple is where I think it is, that's a week's ride or more away. We might not be able to catch Mallory's gang before they hit the town, even if we didn't have to take those women back to Buckskin first. As it is, they'll probably be well into Mexico before we can get down there.
Good thing we're not lawmen or army, then. I don't intend to let a little thing like a river stop us.
I'm glad to hear that. I feel pretty much the same way.
What are you boys gonna do with me and Warren?
That the fella with his arm in a sling?
Uh-huh.
We'll plant him. He made the mistake of drawing iron outside. As for you, I think you'll like the jail in Buckskin. The way you and your gang blew away its front, you'll be able to see the gallows from your cell.
Magdalena Elena Luisa Orion took a deep breath, gathered her courage, and pushed the bat wings aside. She strode into the Black Bull like it was a nice, civilized parlor in somebody's house, rather than the bawdiest hell-roarinest saloon in all of Sweet Apple, Texas. It was better known, for good reason, as the Lord's Waiting Room by those wags who found something amusing about murder and sudden death. Maggie Orion didn't think it was funny at all. Even in the middle of the afternoon like this, the Black Bull was crowded. Hard-faced, roughly dressed men lined the bar and threw back shots of whiskey so vile that to call it panther piss or rattlesnake juice was being generous. Other men slapped cards on green felt and eyed their opponents with squinty malevolence, as if they were about to accuse each other of cheating and get their guns to blazing at any second. Booze and games of chance weren't the only attractions at the Black Bull. Some of the patrons were more interested in the women in low-cut, gaudy dresses who delivered drinks and made their way among the tables, allowing the men to paw. Sometimes one of those hombres would grab a woman's hand and lead her up the stairs to the little rooms on the second floor, where the saloon's other main business happened. The faces of the soiled doves were just about as hard and flinty as those of the men, although the paint daubed on them concealed it a bit. Maggie felt her face glowing warmly as she took in the carousing in front of her. The curses, the lewd, raucous laughter, the smells of cheap tobacco smoke, spilled liquor, unwashed flesh, and the waste products of untold individuals. All of it combined to make Maggie's head spin so furiously, she was afraid she was going to be sick, pass out, or both. Her presence wasn't unnoticed. Eyes started to turn toward her as she stood just inside the saloon's entrance. Maggie felt a wave of irritation go through her. They were all looking at her like she had two heads or something. She was a perfectly normal 22-year-old woman. A little short, maybe, and not as pretty as some of the saloon women. But her long, thick, dark hair was clean and shone from brushing. Her skin held a faint olive hue she inherited from her Mexican mother. Her eyes were a startling shade of green, a legacy from her Irish father. What really set her apart from the other women in the room was her demure gray dress, which had long sleeves and buttoned up modestly to the throat, rather than helping half of her bosom hang out. Not that she wouldn't look good in the kind of shameless get-up those hussies sported, she thought. She would look just fine, if that was the sort of woman she wanted to be. But she didn't. She was respectable, which made her something of an oddity in Sweet Apple, Texas.
Ahem.
She looked at the man in the dark suit and fancy vest standing at the end of the bar.
Mr. Delacroix, you said you were going to send Oliver to school today.
Pierre Delacroix, the owner of the Black Bull Saloon, was from New Orleans, and the soft mixture of accents that characterized those from the Crescent City was in his voice as he spread his hands.
1,000 pardons, Senorita O'Ryan. The promise slipped my mind. And no man should ever be allowed to forget a promise made to a lady, especially one as lovely as you, mademoiselle.
Delacroix was tall, slender, and handsome. No doubt the sporting women who worked for him thought he was just about the best-looking fella to ever come down the pike. Maggie had no doubt Delacroix could have any of those girls anytime he wanted them. That would be true even if they didn't work for him. But she was immune to his charms. All she cared about were the children of Sweet Apple. She took upon herself the task of educating those youngsters. She didn't intend to allow anything to sway her from her goal, not even the trepidation she felt at entering a place like the Black Bull, and certainly not the easy smile and charm of the saloon's owner.
Oliver is already behind the other children in his schooling. It's important he not miss any more time in class.
We have moved around a lot, Oliver and I. But I know that a boy needs to learn more than the things he can learn in such a fine place as this. I will see to it that Oliver comes to school tomorrow, Senorita O'Ryan. You have my word on that.
Maggie didn't point out he gave her his word before, more than once, in fact. And Oliver still missed more days of school than he attended. But she forced herself to nod.
Thank you.
All she wanted now was to get out of here. She turned away and started toward the bat wings.
Senorita O'Ryan.
Yes?
Come back any time, ma chérie.
She flushed. He was making fun of her. She hurried out, slapping the bat wings aside. They swung back the other way a little faster than she expected.
Oh!
Maggie stalked away along the boardwalk in front of the saloon. She knew she shouldn't let things like the encounter with Pierre Delacroix bother her. By now, she should be used to the mocking smiles and the barely suppressed laughter. She was always the misfit, the ugly child who bettered herself by sheer stubbornness, fierce determination, and a surprisingly keen intellect. She worked hard at whatever honest, respectable job she could find, and they weren't easy to come by in a hellhole like Sweet Apple. She saved her money and got out, paying for her own education at a school for teachers in Waco. But something drew her back to the squalid border settlement where she grew up. The railroad came to Sweet Apple, and the town was growing. As it grew, there would be more and more children. Children who needed an education. Maggie realized providing that education was her calling. She didn't know she would spend more time trying to get parents to send their children to class than she would spend teaching those children. As she looked around the settlement's wide, dusty main street, she spotted a freight wagon rolling along driven by Fred Blevins. He had 5 children of school age who seldom showed up at the one-room adobe school on the edge of town.
Mr. Blevins! Mr. Blevins, if I could talk to you for a minute.
Blevins turned his head and looked back over his shoulder at her, then faced forward again and whipped up his team of mules to get them moving faster.
Oh, dear.
She wasn't going to do anything as undignified as chase him down the street. At least he saw her and knew she hadn't forgot about his children and their need for an education. She would never forget about the children, no matter what the people of Sweet Apple thought about her. She turned around and started looking for other parents of wayward students.
Sweet Apple! Coming into Sweet Apple, Texas!
Seymour Standish suppressed the groan of relief that tried to well up in his throat. At last, after long days and longer nights, he was reaching the end of his hellish journey. Uncle Cornelius bought the train tickets for Seymour. Naturally, it didn't occur to him to waste the company's money on extravagances like a sleeping compartment. Seymour slept sitting up on the same hard bench seat he rode during the day. From New Jersey to Chicago, down to St. Louis, through Little Rock and Texarkana and Fort Worth and San Antonio, and then on west to Del Rio and still farther west, following the valley of the Rio Grande toward El Paso. Seymour lost track of the days he spent in this rocking, swaying railroad car, breathing air choked by cinders and smoke swirling in through the windows, all of them open in an attempt to relieve the stifling heat. All he knew for certain was he was exhausted, miserable, and every muscle in his body was stiff and sore. But now his destination was at hand. No matter how bad Sweet Apple was, it must be better than this damn train. He pushed his spectacles up on his nose, reached under his seat for his carpet bag, and pushed his spectacles up again, since bending over made them slip down. He picked up his hat from where it sat on the bench seat next to him. For part of the trip, a large, gaudily dressed salesman sat there. When the fellow dozed off, his head wound up resting against Seymour's shoulder. Seymour was sickened by the smell of bay rum and stale sweat wafting from the man, but there was nothing he could do about it. He wasn't going to risk a confrontation by asking the man to move. Thankfully, Seymour didn't have a seatmate since the train left San Antonio. He was able to doze a little himself. The Baldwin locomotive with its diamond-shaped smokestack rolled into the station at Sweet Apple, pulling a long string of cars behind it. The locomotive came to a stop beyond the station, so its boiler lined up with the water tank raised on stout wooden legs. This was a water stop, so the train would be here for a while. The position brought the passenger cars even with the long platform attached to the depot. Seymour looked out the window at the low adobe building with its red tile roof. Architecture was certainly different in Texas than back east. Brick buildings were rare, and there were no buildings taller than 2 stories. In fact, as he looked down Sweet Apple's main street stretching behind the depot, he saw some of the buildings were constructed to appear to have 2 stories when there really wasn't anything behind the upper part of the facade. He supposed that was what was meant by false front. He heard the term before, but couldn't remember where. Well, pondering frontier architecture was interesting, he supposed, but it didn't get him any closer to accomplishing his goal, which was to establish as many new accounts for Standish Dry Goods, Inc. as he could in Sweet Apple and the surrounding area. He settled his hat on his head, grasped the handle of his carpet bag, and stood up to leave the train. He would have a porter recover his sample case from the baggage car. The porter placed steps by the platform at the rear of the car, so Seymour went down them to the station platform, clutching his carpet bag to him as he did so, as if afraid someone might take it from him. He had no idea what to expect from these Westerners. If they were all like the rowdies and hell raiders populating the yellow-backed dime novels, he must be cautious indeed. Nobody seemed to be paying him much attention, though. In fact, nobody was paying any attention to him. He wasn't sure whether to be relieved or irritated that he was such a non-entity in their eyes. The smell in the air was even more disturbing. Mixed with the smoke and oil from the train was a haze of dust. Underlying that was the potent stench of manure. He looked behind him through a gap between cars and saw the source of that less than fragrant aroma. On the other side of the tracks stretched a long line of pens occupied by hundreds, if not thousands, of cattle. Several large ranches were located in the area, and they shipped their stock from Sweet Apple. The cattle weren't the only producers of manure. The street was dotted with piles of droppings from the many horses moving here and there. The same was true back east, of course. Horses weren't any different there. New Jersey had its share of trains and factories producing plenty of thick, choking smoke. Trenton was no bed of roses, Seymour told himself. He just thought it smelled worse here because everything else was so different. The buildings, the people, the way they dressed and spoke, the fact men openly carried guns in public.
Watch where the hell you're going, mister!
The collision against Seymour's shoulder jolted him. He nearly dropped his carpet bag. He looked around and saw a man in a big black hat glaring at him. The man wore a black vest over a red shirt, and around his waist was buckled a black gun belt with the ivory-handled butt of a revolver sticking up from the attached holster. Seymour's heart began to pound harder as he realized he was looking at the most dangerous of frontier species, the gunfighter.
I'm sorry, sir, but I believe that you ran into me.
What?
Perhaps I was mistaken. I'm sure my own carelessness was to blame.
Damn right it was. Now get the hell out of my way.
But I'm not in your way.
Seymour groaned inwardly. What was prompting him toward this foolish behavior?
I was just going down to the baggage car to retrieve my sample case.
Salesman, eh? I might have known you was one of them drummers. Bunch of pansy-faced dudes. Fine blazes, don't y'all go back where you come from and leave folks alone.
I don't want to bother anyone.
Well, you're bothering me just by being here. Get back on that damn train.
But I can't do that. My uncle sent me here.
Oh, so you're just a flunky, is that it? I should have known by looking at you that you couldn't never do nothing except follow somebody else's orders. You ain't got one damn bit of backbone.
Seymour's irritation warred with his nervousness.
I assure you, sir, I'm just as much a vertebrate as you are.
That was a mistake.
I don't know what the hell you're talking about, but it sure sounded like you just called me a liar.
From his limited reading of dime novels, Seymour recalled Westerners hated being called a liar more than almost anything. He set his carpet bag down at his feet and held up both hands, palms out in what he hoped was a peaceful gesture.
I assure you, sir, I meant no such...
Take a swing at me, will you?
The world seemed to explode in Seymour's face. He felt himself going backward, and it felt to him as if he were traveling faster than the train ever managed at its top speed. The impact knocked the breath out of him, so all he could do for a long moment was lie there on the platform and gasp for air, unmoving. His stunned brain became aware people were stepping around and over him, as if they saw him but at the same time didn't see him. They didn't care he had just been knocked down by a madman. That was what happened, Seymour realized. The gunfighter in the black hat struck him in the face. Now the man loomed over him, fists still clenched threateningly.
You want some more, you little son of a bitch? Get up, damn you! Or maybe you'd rather go get a gun and settle this like men.
The last thing Seymour wanted to do was tell this lunatic he already had a gun. The revolver given to him by Rebecca Jimerson during that strange, last-minute visit to his rooming house was packed away securely in his carpet bag. Taking it out would require only a few moments. But that would be the worst thing Seymour could do, and he knew it. This man wanted to kill him. He pushed himself onto an elbow and gasped.
Please, sir, no more. I apologize for offending you. It was entirely my fault.
The gunfighter's mouth twisted in a grimace of distaste as he looked down at Seymour.
You're so scared you're about to piss your pants, ain't you, boy?
Seymour didn't deny the accusation, although he never would have phrased it in such a crude manner.
What's your name?
Seymour. Seymour Standish.
Seymour? Seymour! I reckon it suits you. I ain't never seen a more cowardly little worm than you are. Seymour the Lily-Livered. That's what I'm gonna call you from now on.
The man reached down and grabbed the front of Seymour's coat. He hauled the young Easterner to his feet and then gave him a shove toward the train.
Get your damn sample case. Get out of my sight, Seymour the Lily-Livered. You make me so sick, I think I'm gonna puke.
Trembling violently, Seymour looked around for his hat, which had come off when the gunfighter knocked him down. He spotted it lying nearby on the platform and reached for it. The man's shot knocked Seymour's hat farther along the platform.
What's the matter, Seymour? Can't even pick up your hat?
Shouldn't someone summon the authorities? But the people on the platform just ignored the whole thing, as if there was nothing unusual about someone discharging a firearm in a public place.
Get your hat. Go on, Seymour. Pick it up.
Seymour reached for his hat again. Again, the hat went spinning away as a bullet tore through it. Seymour lunged after it. Maybe if he could get the hat, the man would stop tormenting him. Seymour had to stop in his tracks. In front of his horrified eyes, the hat leaped with every shot. It was ruined now, full of holes from the bullets. As the gun fell silent, Seymour swung around and discovered the weapon was aimed right at him. The opening at the end of the barrel seemed as big around as the bore of a cannon as he stared into it. The gunfighter grinned over the sights at him and pulled back the hammer for another shot.
All it'd take is one bullet. Just one, and you'd be out of your misery, Seymour. And I wouldn't have to look at that scared face of yours no more, neither. But you ain't worth it.
Seymour was so paralyzed by fear, all he could do was stand there and wait for death to claim him. It took a moment for the realization to sink in. The man wasn't going to kill him. In fact, the man appeared to be leaving. He strode past Seymour, deliberately ramming him again with a shoulder as he went by. Seymour staggered but stayed on his feet. The gunman stalked away without looking back. Seymour's pulse pounded like a trip hammer in his head. He couldn't seem to get enough air in his lungs. He felt sick to his stomach.
Here's your sample case, mister.
Seymour jumped as the voice spoke behind him. His head jerked around as he searched for some new threat. All he saw was a middle-aged porter in uniform. The man held Seymour's sample case.
I seen that little run-in you had with that fella. You're lucky he didn't kill you instead of just shooting up your hat. He'd been known to shoot fellas before just because he felt like it.
Who?
He calls himself Cole Halliday. Don't know if that's his real name or not. Probably ain't. He's a bad man, though. Ain't no doubt about that. Thing is, he ain't even the worst man in these parts. Not by a long shot.
The sheriff?
Sheriff's in the county seat, 40 miles from here. And he can't get no deputy to stay down here.
Seymour ran his fingers through his hair. He was calming down a little now, but he was still trembling a little.
What about the local constable or a marshal?
Ain't none. Ain't nobody in these parts damn fool enough to take the job. Well, here you go. Well, that's the only bag you got except that carpet bag, ain't it?
Seymour managed to nod.
Well, you take care now, you hear.
Seymour the Lily-Livered, Seymour the Lily-Livered, Seymour.
The jeering taunts came from behind Seymour. He twisted around and saw several children standing there, grinning and pointing at him. Obviously, they heard what Cole Halliday called him. Now, they were taking cruel pleasure in repeating it.
Stop it! Stop it!
They ignored him and continued their chanting. Seymour clapped his hands over his ears again, as he had when Halliday was shooting.
What sort of town is this I've come to?
The porter paused at the steps leading up to one of the passenger cars and shook his head.
It's sweet apple, mister. Better get used to it.
A few minutes later, Seymour found himself stumbling down the boardwalk along one side of Sweet Apple's main street. He had his carpet bag in one hand, sample case in the other. His ruined hat lay at the bottom of a trash barrel he found in the railroad station as he made his way through the lobby. He would have to buy another hat. He had a little cash with him to take care of incidental expenses, like replacing a hat shot to pieces by a gun-toting lunatic. The little boys who taunted him in the depot trailed behind him. They ignored the discouraging look Seymour sent back over his shoulder at them until finally he couldn't stand their jibes anymore.
Stop that! Didn't your parents ever teach you to respect your elders? Stop that right now or I'll...
He couldn't think of a suitable threat, not being accustomed to threatening anyone about anything.
You're what, Seymour?
We ain't afraid of you. You're too lily-livered to do anything about it, Seymour the lily-livered.
Several people on the street looked at the youths, but no one offered to step in and put a stop to their taunting. A couple of men shook their heads and rolled their eyes, but Seymour wasn't sure if their disdain was directed at the boys or at him. He thought he had a pretty good idea, though.
If you don't stop, I'll tell your fathers.
That would shut them up, he told himself. He saw right away how wrong he was.
You just try it, mister. My paw's down and the Black Bull boozing up. He'll whip your scrawny ass up one side of the street and down the other if you interrupt his drinking.
Seymour fumed helplessly as the gangster continued to laugh. Finally, one of them on the boardwalk stepped forward and came toward them.
This gentleman.
For a second, Seymour thought the little devils were going to ignore the man's scolding, but they turned away and started across the street, dodging around several piles of horse dung. Seymour heaved a sigh of relief and turned to his rescuer.
Thank you, sir. I was at my wit's end trying to deal with those imps.
The man was taller than Seymour and considerably heavier. An ample belly bulged the vest he wore under a brown tweed suit. He wore a bowler hat, and a waxed mustache spread its wings under a prominent red nose. That nose, and the network of veins in his cheeks, marked him as a drinking man. But Seymour didn't care about that right now, even though he didn't approve of imbibing alcohol. At the moment, he was just grateful for the assistance.
I'll better be glad you didn't go down to the Black Bull looking for Andy's pa. He gets belligerent whenever anything interrupts his drinking, just like the little bastard said.
You sound like an educated man. I was beginning to think there weren't any in this town.
Oh, I'm educated, but that doesn't necessarily make me intelligent. I am still here, aren't I? Jameson Heathcote is the name. I am the editor and publisher of the local newspaper.
Oh! Ooh!
Seymour was about to shake hands with the journalist when something struck his arm. Something warm and wet splattered across his cheek. Seymour thought he had been shot and that blood splashed into his face. He gazed down in horror to see how badly he was hurt. Instead, he saw a large clump of particularly runny horse dung clinging to his coat sleeve, just below his shoulder. Two of his tormentors had returned. One of them flung the manure at him. Now they both turned and ran.
You might want to take your handkerchief and wipe your face.
Stonily, Seymour cleaned the filth from his face. Then he started to put the handkerchief back in his pocket, stopped, and looked at it in disgust instead, and then flung the ruined cloth down. He didn't see any rubbish barrel, but he didn't care. No one seemed to care about anything good and decent in Sweet Apple, so why should he be any different?
The newspaper office is right here.
Heathcote waved toward a nearby doorway.
Why don't you come in and sit down for a minute? You look like you need to catch your breath and get your wits about you.
Thank you. Thank you, Mr. Heathcote. I think you must be the only man with any decency left in this town.
Oh, I try. Maybe you should get that handkerchief and clean your coat sleeve before we go in, too.
Seymour retrieved the handkerchief from the ground and wiped away as much of the dung as he could from his sleeve. Then he threw the handkerchief into the street this time. Let the hooves of passing horses grind it into the dust. He didn't care. Inside the newspaper office, with its pervasive smell of ink that Seymour found preferable to the stench outside, Heathcote sat him down in a ladder-backed chair and brought him a cup of coffee from a pot simmering on a stove in the corner. Seymour would rather a cup of tea, but he doubted anyone in Sweet Apple knew how to brew one. He took a grateful sip of the coffee.
Bit too much bite to it?
No, it's fine. Thank you. Is this newspaper office the lone bastion of civilization in Sweet Apple?
Well, I don't know about that. We have a school when poor Maggie O'Ryan can convince enough of the parents to send their young'uns. And there are two churches, one Catholic and one foot-washing Baptist.
Seymour had no idea what a foot-washing Baptist was, but at the moment he wasn't curious enough to ask. He took another sip of the coffee. Now, more accustomed to it, he could feel its bracing effect. Heathcote sat down at a paper-littered desk.
What brings you to Sweet Apple, Mr.
Standish. Seymour Standish.
Yes, I heard what those rapscallions were calling you. What was that about?
Seymour hated to confess to the humiliation he suffered at the train station, but there were plenty of witnesses on hand. If J. Emerson Heathcote was any sort of a newspaperman, he would learn the story by nightfall anyway. So Seymour told him what happened, trying not to paint himself in too unflattering a light. That wasn't easy to do, though, considering the circumstances. The story made him sound like a craven coward, which, he supposed, he was. Since Heathcote asked what brought him to Sweet Apple, Seymour moved on to that subject in short order, telling him about Standish Dry Goods, Inc. of Trenton, New Jersey, and how his uncle Cornelius sent him here to establish the company in West Texas. Heathcote listened with rapt interest, asking a question every now and then to keep Seymour talking.
When I first heard the name of the place my uncle was sending me, I thought it would be a nice, refined town.
Oh, well, you were way off about that, weren't you? Some folks call Sweet Apple the Lord's waiting room, because hardly a day goes by here that we don't have at least one killing. Sometimes there's more than that.
Has, today's killing already taken place?
Oh, yes. A couple of greasers stabbed each other to death in a cantina early this morning. But don't let that put you off your guard. Like I said, sometimes we'll have five or six men cross the divide in a day's time.
Die, you mean?
Yeah, that's right.
And there's no law here? No law at all?
None to speak of. The last couple of deputies the sheriff sent down here to establish law and order got killed. Now nobody else will try. It would take a team of wild horses to drag the sheriff himself down here, and I'm not sure even they could accomplish it. He's a politician, you know. A while back, the respectable folks in town, and there are some, you know, we got together and decided to hire a marshal. The damn fool who took the job lasted a week before he was gunned down. Next one was dead in 4 days. Since then, well, nobody wants the job anymore, and I don't suppose you can blame them.
Seymour shook his head.
Incredible. It's just incredible such a place could exist in this day and age. I know that Texas is still the Wild West, so to speak, but surely there's some way to establish law and order here.
Well, if you figure it out, you tell me, Mr. Standish, and I'll print it in the paper. In the meantime, have you got a place to stay while you're in town?
No, not yet. I thought perhaps I'd rent a room in a local boarding house.
There aren't any. We've got a hotel, though, and there are usually some vacant rooms there. I'd show you myself, but I've got a paper to get out.
Oh, don't let me interfere with your work. I've already taken up enough of your time and imposed on your hospitality. If you could just tell me where to find the hotel.
Go on down the street past the Black Bull. That's the biggest saloon in town. You can't miss it. The hotel's in the next block on the same side of the street.
Thank you.
Seymour started to lift his hand as if he were about to tip his hat politely before he remembered he no longer had a hat. As he stepped out into the late afternoon heat, he caught a whiff of the stink coming from his dung-smeared sleeve. He didn't know if it would be possible to get his coat clean, but he intended to try. He hoped there was a laundry somewhere in town and decided they could probably tell him at the hotel where to find one. Carrying his carpet bag and sample case, he started in that direction. The train was still at the station, Seymour noted as he looked in that direction. He could go back down there, he told himself, climb aboard the train and keep riding it until it reached the end of the line. He would have to purchase another ticket, but he could do that. He didn't really care where he went, as long as it was away from this terrible place called Sweet Apple. But if he did that, he would be abandoning his job and letting down his Uncle Cornelius. Worse than that, he would be letting down the company and his father's memory. He was here, and he was just going to have to make the best of a bad situation. The train was leaving the station at last. With it went Seymour's chance to escape, at least until the next train came through. He turned back toward the hotel. Two riders were racing their mounts along the street toward him. The men were drunk, or naturally exuberant, or both. One of them pulled a gun from its holster at his waist. Then his eyes widened as he realized there was a young woman standing on the boardwalk in front of him, and she seemed rooted to the spot with terror, unable to move. Without stopping to think about what he was doing, Seymour dropped his carpet bag and sample case and threw himself forward. Maggie O'Ryan barely had time to realize what was happening. At the moment, she didn't fully understand how close she came to dying. That was because the fall knocked the wind out of her, and her brain didn't really comprehend anything, except she must breathe. She finally grasped the idea that whoever grabbed her was now lying on top of her. She put her hands against his shoulders, pushed, and gasped.
Can't breathe!
Maggie found herself looking up into the face of a young man with slender, delicate features and brown eyes. As she pushed at him, understanding dawned in his eyes, and he rolled off of her, a bright red flush appearing on his face as he did so. Maggie's face grew warm, too, but she was too busy trying to catch her breath to worry a great deal about it. She pushed herself upright. A crowd of people surged out of the Black Bull, led by Pierre Delacroix, who looked angry that someone just shot out one of his front windows. His expression changed to one of concern when he saw Maggie sitting on the boardwalk. He hurried over to her.
Now, Mademoiselle O'Ryan, are you hurt?
I'm all right.
She looked over at the young man who tackled her.
Thanks to this gentleman here.
He was still blushing red.
I apologize for any, impropriety, ma'am.
Oh, nonsense. You saved my life, sir. You have my gratitude.
He hesitated, but then clasped her hand. His movements were awkward and nervous. It was an inauspicious meeting, Maggie thought, as they shook hands. They were both sitting on a dusty boardwalk surrounded by drunken louts from the saloon. At least the crowd began to diminish as the Black Bull's patrons began to file back inside, anxious to return to their drinks and cards.
Allow me to help you up, senorita.
The young man scrambled upright too and began brushing dirt and dust off his brown suit. Maggie sniffed. A distinctive odor came from the stranger, and she saw a darker brown blotch on his coat sleeve that could be only one thing. He noticed.
I'm sorry. Some young hooligans threw some... well, pelted me with...
That's all right. You still saved my life, and I'm grateful to you, sir.
Seymour Standish.
It took Maggie a second to realize he had just introduced himself.
I'm Maggie O'Ryan. Magdalena Elena Louisa O'Ryan, to be precise.
Precision is good. I mean, one should always be precise in one's speech, at least to the extent possible.
Oh, I agree.
Did you see who was responsible for this atrocity, Senorita O'Ryan?
Not really. It was just a couple of cowboys, inebriated, no doubt. I'm sorry I can't tell you who they were. I know you'd like to make the man who fired the shots pay for your window.
The cost of a pane of glass, dear though it may be, worries me less than your health, mademoiselle.
Seymour Standish frowned a little.
Are you French or Spanish, sir?
Delacroix smiled and shrugged.
Cajun by birth, mon ami, but this close to the Mexican border, one becomes Spanish, too.
He turned back to Maggie.
Would you like to come back inside and sit down for a moment to catch your breath? Perhaps a small glass of sherry to brace you?
No, I'm fine.
Despite the fact Delacroix was making fun of her earlier, she sensed now he was genuinely concerned.
If you want to do something for me, make sure Oliver attends school tomorrow.
He will be there, senorita. On that, you have my word.
I could, walk you home, Miss O'Ryan, just to make sure no other incidents occur.
That's not necessary.
Despite the gratitude she felt, Maggie couldn't help but remember how it felt to have this young man lying on top of her. She didn't want to compound that embarrassment for either of them. Seymour's face still glowed, and her ears were warm.
I'm sure you have business of your own to attend to.
I was just on my way down to the hotel to rent a room. I am here in Sweet Apple on business. I represent Standish Dry Goods, Incorporated, of Trenton, New Jersey.
Really? I've never been farther east than Waco. I can't imagine traveling all the way to Texas from someplace like New Jersey.
It was a long, arduous journey.
Well, I have to get back to the school and prepare tomorrow's lessons.
Seymour lifted a hand toward his head, which was hatless, then stopped.
Yes, of course. Good day to you, Miss O'Ryan.
Good day, Mr. Standish.
Maggie turned and started along the boardwalk. She brushed dust off her dress. A part of her wanted to look back, but she didn't do it. A lady always maintained a proper air of decorum that didn't include turning to stare at a handsome young man. She felt her face growing warmer again. Seymour Standish was handsome, no doubt about that, but he had nothing to do with her. He just happened to be there at the right time and place to save her life. That was all. What she felt was nothing more than simple gratitude. She told herself that several times. By the time she reached the small adobe school building on the edge of town, she believed it.
You a drummer, no?
No. I mean, yes. I mean, I'm a salesman for Standish Dry Goods, as I told Miss O'Ryan. My father established the company.
Even as he spoke, his eyes were still on Maggie O'Ryan as she walked along the street. He told himself he was watching her only to make certain no other untoward incidents befell her. The fact she was an attractive young woman had nothing to do with it.
Your father owns the company. And you are a traveling salesman? Sent to this border hellhole, no less.
My father passed away. My uncle runs the company now, although I own an equal share of it. He's the one who sent me here, and I'm sure he had no idea what sort of place Sweet Apple really is. I think he chose it simply by the name.
Ah, you were the one from the railroad station. Some of my customers were talking about your encounter with Cole Halliday. Now I know why the name was familiar. You are Seymour the...
Even though the man stopped short without uttering the offensive nickname, Seymour closed his eyes. Did everyone in town already know about his humiliation? How could he possibly hope to establish any new accounts with the local merchants when he was nothing but an object of derision and ridicule?
I am Pierre Delacroix, the owner of this establishment. Would you care to come in and have a drink? On the house, of course.
I don't imbibe.
No? I'd like to repay the debt I owe you for saving the life of the charming Senorita O'Ryan.
You and Miss O'Ryan?
The saloon keeper smiled and lifted his shoulders in an eloquent shrug. Seymour couldn't imagine any sort of romantic relationship between Maggie O'Ryan and this suave Cajun saloon keeper. Miss O'Ryan struck him as the prim and proper type. Of course, that was the way he regarded all women unless and until they gave him reason to revise his opinion of them. But none of this was any concern of his, he reminded himself.
Not only that, but Senorita O'Ryan and her school represent one of the last vestiges of culture in this misbegotten settlement. Though my own son is a, shall we say, less than enthusiastic student, I would not like to see the school close.
Well, we agree on that. Education is important.
Come, have a drink.
No, thank you. I mean no disrespect, but I've had a tiring day. I just want to rent a hotel room, find a laundry, have something to eat, and get some sleep.
Ah, yes, the laundry.
Delacroix looked at the stain on Seymour's sleeve and wrinkled his nose.
There is a Chinese gentleman named Wing who operates such an establishment. The hotel can send your garment down to him. I fear that Monsieur Wing will have a formidable task awaiting him, however.
Seymour picked up his carpet bag and sample case.
Thank you for the information.
He started down the block toward the hotel.
Come back any time, except perhaps when Monsieur Halliday is in attendance.
Seymour understood what the Cajun meant. Delacroix didn't want any incident such as the one at the train station to occur in his saloon. The sight of Seymour might provoke Cole Halliday to gunplay again. The clerk in the hotel lobby sneered at Seymour's soiled coat sleeve, but rented him a room anyway. The man agreed to send Seymour's clothes to the laundry. With a key to room 11 in hand, Seymour hauled his bags up the stairs to the hotel's second floor. The room was small and spartanly furnished with a bed, a chair, a tiny table with a basin on it, and a chamber pot. Several nails driven into the wall served as a wardrobe. There was one window with a thin, threadbare curtain hanging over it. The air inside the room was stifling. Seymour put his bags on the bed and went over to the window to open it. He found himself looking out at Sweet Apple's main street. Roughly clad men strolled up and down the boardwalks. Others galloped heedlessly along the street. In the next block, two women leaned out an open window in what had to be a house of ill repute, judging by their indecent attire, and called lewd invitations down to the men below.
Oh, Uncle Cornelius, what sort of hell on earth have you sent me to?
By the time Seymour crawled out of the lumpy, uncomfortable bed the next morning, he was ready to flee Sweet Apple by train, stagecoach, or any other means of conveyance. He would even consider leaving on horseback, though he was a terrible rider, he thought, as he scratched at the numerous welts left behind by the bugs sharing the bed with him. The meal he had in the hotel dining room the night before was barely edible, and he held out no hope breakfast would be any better. He wouldn't have slept much anyway between the rocks in his mattress and the ravenous insects calling it home, but the constant uproar through the open window all night ensured no slumber. Angry shouts, raucous laughter, pounding hoofbeats, tinny piano music, the occasional gunshot or scream of pain or rage. It all blended into an aria sung by demons from the depths of hell, at least to Seymour's ears. He splashed water from the basin on his face and dressed in his spare suit. He sent everything he was wearing the day before out to be cleaned and had no idea when he would get the clothes back. As lawless as Sweet Apple was, it was possible someone might steal the garments and he would never see them again. Rubbing weary eyes, he stumbled down the stairs to the lobby, wondering what sort of evil concoction the cook had for breakfast. The same clerk was still on duty at the desk, and the same sneer was on his narrow, pockmarked face. Seymour was about to go past the desk when he saw the newspaper lying on it. One of the headlines caught his eye. Seymour steadied himself as he picked up the newspaper. It was the Sweet Apple Gazette, according to the masthead. The headline emblazoned below that read, "The Most Cowardly Man in the West?" The subhead below that was, "New Arrival Encounters Local Man, Disgraces Self." Easterner dubbed Seymour the Lily-Livered. The byline was J. Emerson Heathcote, editor and publisher.
That son of a bitch!
Seymour read the story, hardly able to believe what his eyes were seeing. He was so upset he didn't even notice he cursed. Completely uncharacteristic behavior for him. After pretending to befriend him and be sympathetic to his plight, the newspaperman took everything Seymour told him and wrote a story about it, exaggerating the facts so Seymour came across as even more of a bumbling, terror-stricken oaf. Anyone who read this couldn't help but see him as a ludicrous figure, worthy only of scorn and ridicule. His reputation in Sweet Apple was ruined. Seymour was shaken to his core as he realized Miss Maggie O'Ryan would probably read this newspaper story. Without thinking about what he was doing, his hands clenched, crumpling the newspaper. Seymour saw and ignored the grinning jackanapes in the lobby. He had finally been pushed too far. He flung the door open and went outside, ready for a showdown. J. Emerson Heathcote was going to rue the day he'd made sport of Seymour Standish. Seymour hadn't gone half a block toward the newspaper office before someone called out.
Hey, it's Seymour the Lily-Livered.
Don't look at him crossways. He's liable to faint dead away.
Hell, he's the biggest coward in the whole damn country.
The laughter threatened to overwhelm Seymour. Even though he stormed out of the hotel with the idea of giving Heathcote a well-deserved thrashing, Seymour knew that would never happen. The journalist was bigger, and Seymour was no fighter. He turned to slink back toward the hotel. He could stay in his room until the next eastbound train arrived, leave Sweet Apple, and go home. Uncle Cornelius would be disappointed in him, and he would be letting his father's memory down. But there was nothing Seymour could do about that. He just wasn't cut out for life on the frontier. Then he thought again about Maggie Orion, and to his great surprise, he felt his backbone stiffening. The trio of loafers who poked fun at him still lounged nearby on the boardwalk. He turned toward them.
That will be quite enough out of you three.
The men fell silent and stared at him in obvious surprise. They were in their 30s, roughly dressed, with beard stubble on their faces and guns on their hips. Not the sort of men Seymour should be confronting. He supposed he had lost his mind. Even so, it felt good to put them in their place. Unfortunately, their surprise didn't last long. One by one, they scowled, and then the ugliest of the three, a dark-complexioned man with a wandering eye, stepped forward.
What'd you say, dude?
Seymour's instincts told him to apologize, to grovel, if necessary, and then to get back into the hotel as quickly as possible. But instead of doing that, he glared right back at the man.
I said that will be enough out of you three. I won't put up with any more childish behavior from ruffians and louts.
Seymour realized everyone within earshot was staring now.
I think Seymour the Lily Liver just called you a name, Jack.
Yeah. He's gonna be damn sorry about it, too. You got a gun, dude?
Seymour could have lied, but he didn't.
As a matter of fact, I do own a firearm. I don't have it with me, but...
Go get it. Right now. You and me are gonna settle this like men, even if you are a worm.
Seymour remembered the dime novels he'd read.
You're saying that you want to have a shootout? With me?
Damn right. Now go get your gun.
Seymour began to tremble inside. His rage evaporated. This madman was going to kill him if he didn't do something right now to stop it.
Listen, perhaps I spoke too hastily.
Forget it. It's too late for that now. I ain't interested in no damn apology. Get your gun and face me out there in the street like a man.
Seymour's mind cast about frantically for any reasonable excuse.
But I don't have a gun belt and a holster like the one you're wearing.
I don't have a gun belt.
Tell you what, dude. I'll let you hold your gun while we do this. I don't mind giving you a little advantage.
Except it wasn't really an advantage, Seymour thought. By the time he could lift the revolver from Rebecca, pull back the hammer, aim the weapon, and press the trigger, Jack would shoot him 3 or 4 times at least.
Isn't there anything I can do?
You mean you want to back down like a whipped dog? Sure, but you gotta act like a dog, mister. Get down on all fours and bark for me.
Seymour swallowed. This was going to be the worst humiliation of his life, but he had to do it. Otherwise, his life wouldn't continue much longer.
But that ain't all. When you're done barking, you're gonna crawl over here on your belly like the cur you are and lick my boots.
Seymour looked. Jack wore high-topped black boots. The boots were filthy, covered with dung, both dried and recent, and God knew what else.
You're speaking metaphorically, of course. You can't expect me to actually lick.
Either that or go get that gun of yours, Seymour.
By now, Seymour was shaking all over. The street was silent as the bystanders waited to see what he would do. He lowered himself into a crouch, preparing to get down on all fours as Jack ordered. He could barely believe it himself, but he had no choice. He put a hand on the boardwalk and in the process glanced along the street toward the far end of the settlement. He saw a building there with a couple of cottonwood trees next to it. The door was open. Children were going inside. It was Maggie's school. She was nowhere in sight, but that didn't mean anything. She didn't have to see what was about to happen. She would hear all about it, probably before the day was over. No matter what she already heard about him or read in the newspaper, this would be worse. This would be so bad she would never be able to see or talk to him again without thinking about how he crawled like a dog and licked this man's filthy boots. He would rather be dead than suffer that, he realized.
All right. I'll fetch my firearm.
You serious, dude?
That's right. The gun is up in my hotel room. You'll wait here for me?
Jack's face darkened with anger.
I never run out on a gunfight yet. Damn right I'll wait for you. Fact is, I'll be waiting right out yonder in the street, waiting to kill you.
Seymour jerked his head in a nod and turned toward the door of the hotel.